This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
We've had seismic changes in the last decade, and we've adapted to them. But what comes next?
We really talk about autonomous business processes rather than just automating business processes.
I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte. Our latest episode explores how to build a digital brain and future-proof your business. Vision to Value on Resilient Edge is available now, wherever you listen to podcasts.
The following advertisement feature is presented by GoTurkey. Most travelers only scratch the surface of Turkey. The real Turkey is found on a detour. Plan your next trip to southeastern Anatolia to witness a culinary crossroads, surprising history, and adrenaline-fueled mountain trails. The southeast of Turkey is home to what the country might be most famous for: food. In Gaziantep, taste the flavors that makes it a UNESCO-recognized creative city of gastronomy. Eat baklava in the home of baklava. Eat pistachios in the home of the pistachio. Hike up UNESCO-recognized Mount Nemrut, where history is larger than life, literally. Where giant statues were built by a king who wanted to be remembered for eternity. It worked, as his head is up there, set in stone, 2,000 years later. And take a tour around one of civilization's biggest mysteries, Göbekli Tepe. Nobody knows who built these stunning settlements. Historians predict it was built more than 11,000 years ago, before farming, the invention of the wheel. But somehow it was built. Who done it? If you want to get more from your holiday and skip the beach and crowds, take a detour to southeastern Anatolia and discover more about the world in Turkey.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. A virtual space where you, me, top experts, a big issue and 28 minutes come together in an explosion of understanding. In this edition, the Ever Given, the vast ship that got jammed in the Suez Canal at the end of March, created a bottleneck in global supply chains and had people suggesting we should be making more of our stuff at home. So should we? On March the 23rd, the good ship the Ever Given got wedged across the Suez Canal and created a metaphor that could be seen from space. It stood for the precariousness of global trade in an age of shocks. Already, leaders of some nations had been calling for more national self-sufficiency. There was Donald Trump with America First, and more recently, the Indian leader Narendra Modi has talked of getting vocal for local in manufacturing. Would Britain be wise to follow suit? Step into the briefing room and I'll try and find out. Back to Suez, because I want to know what the butterfly effect of that blockage was. First into the briefing room this week is Claire Jones of the Financial Times. She's the editor of a daily column called Trade Secrets and joins me from Frankfurt. Claire Jones, we know that one very large ship blocked the canal. How much shipping actually got delayed as a consequence?
So the Suez Canal is a massive artery for world trade. The reason being is that it shaves about a week off the time it takes to get from Asia to Europe. So you have, in usual times, about 50 vessels going through it a day, the bulk of which, in terms of tonnage, are container ships. So gradually there were more and more container ships becoming stuck, waiting to pass through. At the height, there were about 80 ships with cargoes worth about $80 billion US dollars on board.
$80 billion?
Yes. This is another issue here, is that what we've seen over the past few weeks could not come at a worse time for the people whose job it is to get goods from A to B. There were already a lot of pandemic-related log jams in the system. And what we've seen in the Suez Canal is just going to add to that. Well, it just being very difficult to get goods around the world right now.
People will forget about the Suez blockage fairly quickly. But if your component for a particular product was stuck in the canal for 6 days, presumably you've not yet quite felt the pain from it.
You've probably not felt the pain straight away, but I suspect we'll see a lot in the coming weeks and months. The reason being, world trade has been booming. What we saw last spring when the pandemic first hit was factories shutter, and then we saw a collapse in world trade. Now, what's happened since then is it's gone whoosh. The reason is we're all sitting at home, and rather than spending on things like events, things like eating out, which is what we usually spend most of our disposable income on, we're spending on things instead. So we've seen demand for consumer durables, things like expensive exercise bikes, things like games consoles, shoot through the roof. How do those objects get to us? They get to us overwhelmingly by container ship. The other thing to remember here is that companies run supply chains very, very lean. There's not a lot of inventory building. So what you're going to see is manufacturers are going to be short a specific part. They're not going to be able to get the goods to market as a result of that. What we've seen already as a result of the blockage in the Suez Canal is Brompton, the UK bicycle manufacturer, saying they expect to see the pinch in about 6 to 8 weeks as key components become unavailable.
Will there be an effect also on the cost of shipping goods around the world?
What we've seen over the pandemic is this store and demand, and also a problem of containers being in the wrong place. There are an awful lot of empty containers stuck in the US and in Europe when they need to be in Asia. And what that's meant is there's not a lot of capacity on these container ships to go from East Asia to Europe or the US. And as a result, costs have soared. Before the pandemic, if you wanted to take a 40-foot container from East Asia to Northern Europe, it would cost you about $2,000. At the moment, it would cost you about $8,000. Now, people in the industry did not expect to see a massive increase in costs as a result of this blockage. But what it may well do is mean that it takes a lot longer for prices to normalise and fall back to where they were pre-pandemic.
Claire Jones. Next, I want to know how Britain came to rely on the things that we eat, wear and drive so often being made elsewhere. Here's David Edgerton, a historian and author of The Rise and Fall of the British Nation.
In the middle of the 19th century, Britain went through an extraordinary political economic transition to free trade. It got rid of the so-called Corn Laws. Indeed, at the end of the 19th century and into the beginning of the 20th century, the United Kingdom imported half its food. Quite unlike any other country in the world, it was utterly dependent on places on the other side of the world. So British beef came from Argentina, from Uruguay, wheat from Canada, Argentina, Australia. And to pay for these imports, it exported. What did it export? It exported manufactured goods, cotton textiles, wool textiles, ships. From the late 19th century, the United Kingdom was the most globalised and interdependent economy on the face of the earth.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go.
In the First World War, the United Kingdom made extraordinary use of this global interdependence. For example, it could get horses from all over the world for action on the Western Front. The Germans, obviously, couldn't do that. It was able to get petrol from the other side of the world. Britain's global orientation gave it global power. But in the interwar years, British globalisation was threatened by two tendencies. The first was the slow growth and sometimes the collapse of world trade. The second was the feeling that the British economy, and in particular the imperial economy, ought to be protected. So the Conservative Party in particular pushes for a policy of national protection and what was called imperial preference. And as part of that, to increase, relatively speaking, the supplies from the empire.
We'll meet again. Don't know where. Don't know when.
During the Second World War, the United Kingdom depended not only on food from overseas, but also raw materials and indeed weapons. It was part of a globalised Allied war effort. But after the war, there was a very strong feeling that the economy ought to become more national on security grounds, to make it less vulnerable to blockade, less vulnerable to economic pressure from other countries. As a result of that, there were great drives to increase domestic food production, a process of achieving self-sufficiency in food over the next few decades. By the 1970s and early 1980s, the United Kingdom was indeed, for the first time since the 19th century, effectively self-sufficient in the foods that could be grown in the United Kingdom. Self-sufficient in grains, self-sufficient in meat. In the case of manufacturers also, there was an extraordinarily strong tendency to ensure that what was consumed in Britain was produced in Britain. In effect, unlike many other economies, the British economy in this period was deglobalizing. When Margaret Thatcher came to power in 1979, she pursued a new policy. And that was a policy of opening up, radically opening up the British economy. British consumers were no longer expected to buy British televisions or British cars or British telephones. They could buy from wherever they wanted in the world, and they did. The British economy became once more a free trading economy. It began to depend, to be interconnected with the rest of the world, just as it had been in the early years of the 20th century. The British economy is, like many others today, deeply interconnected with the world economy. It imports semi-finished manufacturers, it re-exports them, it imports them again. Essentially, what we're talking about is massively interconnected global and European supply chains. We have the circulation across borders of parts of manufacturers, just-in-time global supply chain interconnection, made possible by very cheap transport, made possible also by very cheap and easy telecommunications. We're talking about an IT revolution. It's a very new kind of globalization.
David Edgerton on the way we were and how we changed. Now, given that we have changed, I want to know how vulnerable Britain is in the face of an event like the Suez Canal blockage, or indeed a global pandemic, and to what extent countries really are talking about self-reliance. Joining me now in the briefing room is Dr. John Glenn from the Cranfield School of Management. John Glenn, do you think we're living in a time where protectionist thinking is on the rise? And if it is, does that threaten the way the UK trades?
Yeah, absolutely. I think protectionism is on the rise, and the most obvious examples of it would be the trade war, as it's been portrayed, between North America and China, and perhaps much more closer to home, the issues surrounding Brexit.
Okay, in what ways is the UK vulnerable to imports being disrupted? I mean, we've just seen disruption in the pandemic, but what other ways?
Well, obviously, from my perspective, I would see something like Suez as an event, maybe that crystallises the kind of risks that many companies face on a day-to-day basis. What I think is a bigger risk, things like Brexit, COVID and trade wars, because these are basically systemic changes to the context in which we trade. And that is likely to mean that we have to reconfigure our supply chains in a way that we wouldn't have to in response to something like Suez.
So in other words, we stand in danger of not being able to get certain vital things that we've come to rely upon as a result of both events, but actually as a result of the structure of world trade itself.
Yeah, I mean, there are a myriad of examples. We see things like Brexit causing problems with supplying car parts, second-hand car parts. You know, I phoned the Mirror Man recently in Urmston, Manchester, who promised me he could supply me with a replacement Audi wing mirror and then came back 2 weeks later to say the supply chain had broken down and he wasn't able to do it. And it's all of these small businesses that are really suffering most from this disruption in trade, both from Brexit, COVID and trade wars, because the bigger guys can put systems in place to deal with this. You know, they typically contract out their supply chains to logistics companies, big logistics companies that will take your supply chain complexity, take your supply chain risk, and they'll manage it for you. And then you see smaller companies saying, you know, that Brexit and COVID has been a complete car crash because they're not able to manage those risks. They're not able to manage that complexity.
And it's important to note, isn't it, that a significant part of the goods economy in Britain is small businesses.
Absolutely. About 60% of our goods economy, as you put it, is conducted by SMEs.
So are there areas of strategic supplies of things that which we need to make our goods, which actually are a problem because they're only made by very few countries, and if that's interrupted, then we have difficulties?
Yeah, well, one area that might resonate is computer chips. So, for example, a significant amount of manufacturing activity in the United Kingdom is dependent upon a ready supply of computer chips that typically come from China and East Asia. And the issue is that there's a worldwide shortage of these chips, and therefore, if there is a shortage in that supply chain, that has to be managed. And the added pressure that's brought on the fact that, you know, the demand for these inputs from a global perspective is growing. So we face increased competition for, you know, a limited supply of those inputs. And that's the kind of complexity and risk that we have to manage on a day-to-day basis inside global supply chains.
Are you saying, let's imagine a trade war with China, we could not then, or we would not be in a position then to find and source the chips that we need to make the things which we sell?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as we speak now, I've just come off a call with one of those large logistics companies, and his quote was that this is the craziest global economy that he has seen in 35 years. So yes, even they are struggling to meet the demands at the moment.
What that call suggests is that business is really beginning to become alive to some of the dangers that it faces in supply interruption.
Yes, procurement professionals that I speak to, they come back to me and say, we put those additional factors into our calculations, into our considerations, and then we decide, do we continue to trade with China? Do we continue to trade with North America or the Middle East or wherever? And then on that basis, on the basis of quality, on the basis of risk, we make a decision about how we're going to configure our supply chain.
John Glenn, let's look more closely at one class of product, food. Should we seek to be more self-reliant there? Joining me now is Sue Pritchard. She's the Chief Executive of the Food, Farming and Countryside Commission. Sue Pritchard, how much of our food originates here and how much of it do we import?
So about 55% of our food comes from the UK and the rest is imported. And most of the imported food comes from the EU, about 26% of our total supply. And then we get about 4% each from Africa, from North America, from South America and Asia. And just 2% comes from the rest of Europe and 1% from Australasia. And the UK is most self-sufficient in red meat and dairy, around 75% of that, and cereals, 62%. But only 23% self-sufficient in fruit and veg.
Now, there was quite a lot of panic buying at the beginning of the pandemic a year ago, and everybody got terribly, terribly worried. But actually, food supplies seemed to hold up pretty well. How did we manage that?
Well, the early days of lockdown showed exactly how vulnerable our food systems can be, shelves empty of fresh produce. And in our research at the time, we found that many people were turning to their local suppliers when they couldn't get what they wanted from supermarkets. And some local producers who saw their markets shut down overnight without, for example, the hospitality sector, were able to pivot their businesses to sell direct to customers. But of course, food businesses, big food businesses, worked incredibly hard to manage through that crisis, and government took steps to help, relaxing competition laws to allow supermarkets to work together and relaxing rules around drivers' hours so that deliveries could keep going. But the presence of food on supermarket shelves was not the whole story. So the latest Environment, Food, Rural Affairs Committee report quotes Food Foundation research that in the last 6 months, nearly 6 million adults in the UK experienced food insecurity, and 1.7 million children live in households that are food insecure. And that's defined as when people or households have insufficient or insecure access to food due to resource constraints. So it is true that food reappeared on supermarket shelves fairly quickly. But if more and more people simply can't afford to buy nutritious food regularly, then that alone is not an adequate measure of a secure and a fair food system. So the pandemic experience revealed some of the structural weak points and the need for more self-sufficiency, for better inventories and more diversified food systems, including locally led systems.
Concentrating on food supply, we heard earlier that just-in-time is now a very important part of the industrial process. Do we have just-in-time in food production and delivery as well?
We do. And in that drive for ever cheaper food, businesses are always looking for ways to shave costs out of the system. Storage space is costly, refrigerated storage space is very costly, and the actual logistics all add up. So just-in-time systems take food more directly from ports or producers to supermarket shelves. And just-in-time systems are the way that many retailers and food businesses have been operating to save on costs. And supermarkets can plan in advance for those big buying moments, like say Christmas, but COVID took them by surprise, and that's what led to the short-term supply issues.
In other words, just-in-time actually builds in a kind of a potential precariousness into the system, because if anything goes wrong, you're not just in time because you haven't got the stuff in the warehouse or in the freezer.
That's exactly right. Now, some people say that we're just 2 days from empty shelves because we're relying so much on the just-in-time system, and that does introduce real vulnerabilities right across the whole food system. And so having a range of food supply sources, including increasing UK production and diversifying our imports, is a really important safety net for those sorts of extreme events.
So doesn't this in the end amount to significant subsidies for domestic agriculture and food production? I mean, when you come right down to it.
Well, it's interesting that you use the word subsidy there, David, because often when we talk about other sectors like energy, say, or transport or infrastructure, we talk about investment. We talk about investing in a sector for either competitive advantage or to tackle big global issues like, you know, the climate and nature crisis. But somehow we use the word subsidy when it comes to food systems. So perhaps it's time that we start to rethink how we talk about it and recognise it as the important sector that it is. And instead of talking about subsidising production, we talk about investing in a more sustainable, healthier food system in which producers and people and planet, frankly, can flourish.
Sue Pritchard. My final guest in the briefing room this week is Paul Seabright. He's a professor of economics at the Toulouse School of Economics in southern France. To what extent does he think Britain could or should take measures to reduce its dependence on insecure global trade? Paul, how seriously do you think we should take the Suez blockage? And do you think that companies should be re-evaluating their supply chains as a result of what they've seen?
Companies are re-evaluating their supply chains all the time. I mean, they've been doing that through the COVID pandemic. That's part of running a global value chain in today's economy. You are constantly thinking about disruptions. Things have been happening for much of the past year, some of them to do with the pandemic, but quite a lot of them not. So semiconductor production has been disrupted. There were fires in Japan. There was drought in Taiwan. And there was electricity failure in Texas, all of which shut down semiconductor plants, reacting to which is part of the normal process of what supply chain managers do.
Okay, so they're reevaluating all the time. But as we know, there's been quite a lot of heightened discussion in the last few years about the need to bring production home again. I mean, there was Donald Trump's insistence on America first. We have Narendra Modi talking about the need to have more local production and less importing. And I'm just wondering, if we look at the UK, has there been a movement towards any of that here?
There has been in some respects, but it's not a general solution. The reason for that is that imports sometimes make you vulnerable to disruption that happens abroad, but imports sometimes help you cope with disruption that happens at home. And the example I just gave of the power outages in Texas is a very good example. If the Americans had thought that by relying less on semiconductors from Japan or Taiwan, they'd be safe, they would have discovered the contrary just less than 2 months ago when Texas went into power outage. Sometimes disruption happens at home. So you have an unexpected cold weather spell in Texas and your own factories go down. And that's the point at which you need to be able to rely on supply from abroad. So sometimes importing makes you vulnerable to disruption abroad. Sometimes importing is your lifeline against disruption that happens at home.
I see. That's very interesting. But there's been a lot of discussion, and I mean, and you'll be even more aware of it than I am, that what has happened during globalization has meant a kind of super specialization to the extent that we can suddenly find ourselves in crises short of the things that we need. So the case in the pandemic, for instance, classically, was the production of PPE. And so a lot of people said we should be making that at home. In other cases, people have been talking about vaccines. Why are we dependent upon significant global movements of vaccine when we should be making it home? So there's a lot of emphasis like that. Now, are you saying that essentially you see that happening? You see people talking about it, but it isn't going to happen? Or are you saying you see people talking about it, it may happen a bit, but it shouldn't?
Most things that you want to make at home, unless they're very simple, require components that you may have to get from abroad. So, for example, the BioNTech Pfizer vaccine uses some 280 components sourced from a huge number of countries. And you can try making vaccines at home with only the components that you produce at home, but the chance that you'll produce a vaccine that's effective in time to save you from the pandemic is very much reduced that way. If you want to be quick and responsive to a pandemic, you have to make sure that your vaccine uses the best available ingredients wherever they come from.
In other words, the success of vaccine rollout is actually due to a globalized system.
Exactly. And any country that thought, as for example, France thought, that it could try to produce a vaccine at home and great French technology, it's the country of Pasteur after all, would solve the problem, has been disappointed.
But that really does leave you suggesting that the desire and the policies for moving to a greater self-dependency on more products is essentially a fantasy.
Look, I don't think it's wrong to be worried about the current state of dependence on potentially fragile global supply chains. That's a very reasonable concern. But the solution to that is not self-dependence, it's diversification. It's trying not to be dependent on any one source of supply, including domestic supply. Domestic supply is no less subject to shocks and unexpected shortages and so on than supply from abroad. And I think there's a very reasonable concern that in recent years, the firms that have been constructing global supply chains haven't taken seriously enough the risks of disruption. They didn't take into account pandemic risks, and they haven't taken into account a number of other risks. And similarly, countries were taking into account all sorts of risks in the world economy, but they had really put pandemic risks to one side, in part because we've been so successful at protecting ourselves from the risk of infectious pathogens in the last few decades.
Do you think it's any way possible to reverse the process of globalization?
Well, not if we don't want to become like North Korea. North Korea has cut itself off pretty effectively from the world, and it claims, by the way, to have no cases of COVID because it's shut its borders completely. But unless you want to become like North Korea, you have to accept that the outside world is a source of help for you in crisis as well as a source of risk. Basically, thinking that only bad things come from outside and only good things are inside is a kind of bunker mentality that no country in the modern world can afford.
Paul Seabright, whose conclusion seems about right. Self-reliance, no. Diversification of supply, yes. My thanks to Claire Jones, David Edgerton, John Glenn, Sue Pritchard and Paul Seabright. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Tim Mansell, Paul Moss and Kirstine Knight. The sound was mixed by Rod Farker and the editor was Penny Murphy. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you might like other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. There's the one about whether there might soon be a referendum on the reunification of Ireland. There's the edition in which we investigated the mystery of short selling and the role of hedge funds. And there's our one-hour special on how countries the world over have dealt with the COVID pandemic.
Hello, it's Greg Jenner here, the host of Radio 4's funny history podcast, You're Dead to Me. We are rounding off this current third series by going stateside and focusing on five great stories from American history. We'll be hearing from some of the best historians and comedians from across the pond as we get jazzy with the Harlem Renaissance, enjoy some dry wit in a Prohibition-era speakeasy, discover if the greatest showman, P.T. Barnum, really was quite so great, go exploring with a Native American heroine, Sacagawea, and discover how early America turned itself into a new country and what that even meant. So if you want to learn some new stuff about the history of the New World and laugh while you learn, then check out You're Dead to Me on the BBC Sounds app.
Hallo bei Heute Journal, der Podcast.
Helene, du musst näher ran.
Hallo bei Heute Journal, der Podcast.
Vielleicht noch einen Tick näher.
Hallo bei Heute Journal, der Podcast.
Oh wow, das ist nah.
Na klar, weil ihr jeden Donnerstag mit mir und dem Heute Journal Moderationsteam ungewohnt nah an die Themen kommt, die die Welt bewegen. Na klar, Heute Journal, der Podcast. Jeden Donnerstag, überall, wo es Podcasts gibt.
Kann eine Karriere neugierig sein? Komm zu EY und erlebe es selbst. Arbeite an spannenden Projekten, gestalte die Wirtschaft von morgen und entwickle dich auch selbst weiter. Im Team Assurance, Tax, Consulting oder EY Parthenon, Strategy and Transactions. Shape your future with confidence. Jetzt bewerben auf jobsgermany.ey.com.